Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. I'm Addie, and I am an alcoholic. And I don't know if they left my last initial off on purpose or not, because I know it's changed a bit, you guys, but really, come on now. Can everybody hear me? No? Oh, wow, okay. How about now? Is that better? Okay. I'm a little shorter than most people, I guess. I spent my life wanting to grow longer legs and it never happened, you know. It's kind of that disease of alcoholism that if you're tall, you want to be short, and if your hair is straight, you want it curly, and on and on and on. Yeah, everybody's nodding. I want to thank Bill and Mike for inviting me here. This is an awesome experience. For a lot of reasons, a number of years ago, I attended meetings at the Northside Group in Modesto, and I see some old friends here, and it's just a joy to see Al and Ruth and Bud. Oh, God, you know, I mean, this has been a lot of years, a lot of water under the bridge in that period of time, I'll tell you. That was about that period of time when, I had a long-term marriage at one time. I really did. I had several that were not, but I had one that was. And that particular period in my life, he and I kept trying to put the pieces back together, you know. And all those years that I was drinking, I knew that my problem was him. Without a doubt, it was him. And if he would just behave differently, if he could just love me more, if he could be a little more responsible, and I had, the list goes on ad infinitum, that, oh, God, what a load I had to carry. I mean, it was so... Well, after 23 or some odd years like that, and in sobriety, a year after I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we separated. Now, in the book, it talks about the persistence of the illusion is astonishing. And indeed, it was. We kept getting back together. You know, I mean, sometimes it would be 6 months later, and we'd have a reconciliation. And then it'd be a year go by and some family crisis that occurred. We had a lot of kids. And so it was usually through these family affairs that we would look at each other and think, oh, God, we got to get that family feeling back again. Now, we're both sober in the program, Alcoholics Anonymous, doing the best we can do. Back together we'd go. And I'd moved to Modesto one time. I think it lasted 2 weeks. All the clothes moved in, all the clothes moved out, and lots of boxes. And then the next time it might have been 6 months, and it just went on and on and on and on. And then finally, gratefully, the time came that we had to let go and recognize it was time to move on. And so I have, and so has he. And that's the way it is in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's, as Bud pointed out just a little while ago, it's the journey. My journey's not been dull. But I never liked dull. Never liked dull men either. That's why, apparently, right from the get-go, I was attracted to alcoholics through no fault of my own. I mean, if you had been born in the family I was born into, I mean, you really have to understand my roots. My mother is a member. My stepfather is a member. My stepdad, Bob, has been around now for about 35 years, but he's third step. Before that, there was step, and then the stepdad that raised me, and sometimes it gets a little confusing going back in my history, you know. But essentially, it amounts to this. My mother was a drinking drunk, a drinking alcoholic back in the good old days. I mean, the olden days of prohibition and that sort of thing. And she had a great big brother named Tex Adams. And Uncle Tex was a bootlegger, and my mother was a bootlegger with Uncle Tex. And when she met a handsome little sailor and they got married and had me, this wasn't an opportune thing at that point in time in her life. So my grandparents raised me till my grandmother died when I was six. And I went till, by then, my real father disappeared. The story I got is Uncle Tex gave him $500 to blow town and get out of her life because he was a drunk. I mean, we are instantly attracted. I don't understand it. I can be at a church social. 500 men, and if there's one kook or nut in the room, I'm attracted. Yeah, I mean, isn't he fascinating? Oh, God, I'm in love. Oh, love to be in love. And so anyway, I went to live with my mother and stepdad number one, who was, in all probability, the original Al-Anon. There was no Al-Anon in those days because my mom hadn't found AA yet. And in the next 4 years of my life, I spent with this stepdad and a housekeeper because Mama wasn't around much. She was off with Uncle Tex doing what they did, which was usually promoting some type of business, parting somebody with their money, or her drinking. And by that time, it had gotten real bad. And it had gotten so bad that my stepdad said that if she didn't do something about it, he was going to take custody of me and divorce her. And she got scared. And it was in March of 1941 that my mom was apparently had been on a running drunk. She always left town when she did. And she ended up back in L.A. in a steam bath trying to sweat out the booze so she could go home. And she got scared. She was afraid that this time it was going to be it. And she picked up a magazine at that point in time. And it was March of 1941. And the cover story was about Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that's how I happened to be raised as one of the original AA brats. I grew up with Alcoholics Anonymous all around me, my uncle, my mother. My surrogate family were members of the Hole in the Ground, which my Uncle Tex ultimately founded in Huntington Park. And if I wanted to visit my mom, I'd go to an AA meeting. Now, if you're wondering why it took me a long time to get here, so am I. But, you know, I was not a fast learner. I mean, my problem was not drinking. It had nothing to do. It was him. Before him, it was her. I always had somebody. In fact, stepdad number two, he was very wise. Actually, his name was Jim Willis. He passed away some years ago. He founded Gamblers Anonymous, as a matter of fact. But old Jim, he began to nickname me Poor Little. Poor Little Ad. With good reason. I always said, oh, if I only had a better job, if I only had a better husband, if I only had a better couch, if I only had a better house, everything would be all right and then I'd be happy. You know, that stuff, always stuff. If I had enough of it, it would fill the hole, that empty spot way down inside of me. Yeah, you're nodding, you know what that is. Because no matter what I had, who I was with, it wasn't enough. I spent my life looking for somebody to fix something in me that I didn't even know was wrong and waiting for it to come from the outside, and I did not know that it had to come from within. And I didn't know that when I got so miserable, I had to drink. The choices were removed from me because that was the only thing that allowed me to go on another day without blowing my brains out. I was a suicidal alcoholic. It was not a happy sight. I did raise a bunch of kids, five of them. And there were times in my life when life was relatively good. There was times when he and I got married, and he was a home builder, and he built me a beautiful house in Sacramento, and I had two children already. I'd come up from L.A. to work at Aerojet when it first started out. And that's where I met him. And, oh, my God, I couldn't believe it. Here's this young man, white duck pants and a shirt, shiny white teeth, didn't look like he smoked, tan, you know. He looked like an ad for milk or something or other. He was so healthy, and he water skied, and I thought, you know, that's what I need. I had run to Sacramento from L.A. with a drunk, with my latest thing going on in my life. Unfortunately, I married him, too, for a very short period of time. That didn't last. But that was going to make everything better. Getting out of L.A., moving, getting away from the family because, after all, they were going to influence my actions. Like my Uncle Tex had said something about I was going to hell in a handbasket, and I didn't appreciate that any, I'll tell you that. And I knew that having been raised, my life was not normal as a kid. Now, as a kid, I'd get home from school. On one occasion, a man was out in front of the house on his hands and knees in the middle of DTs talking to somebody who wasn't there, and it scared the pants off of me. And I go in the house, and there's an AA meeting going on. In those days, see, they only had one meeting. When my mother came in 1941, there was only one meeting on the West Coast. And that was in downtown L.A. at a hotel, a Cecil Hotel or something like that. And the only people they had as members were men. There were no other women. My mom was the first woman on the West Coast to become sober. Marty Mann had about a month or two of sobriety back east. And my mother was the next female to come in and have continuous sobriety. And that was March of 1941. But there was only the one meeting. And people would come from all over. These men, they'd come from the valley. They'd come in from San Bernardino. They'd come in from the coast, Orange County, all around, because that's all they had. They had that one meeting, and there was a pretty good, it was the mother group, and it was Frank Randall and a fellow named Mort Joseph and another one named Hal Silverton. And the reason I know them is I knew these people, because they were in and out of our home all the time, and because when I was visiting my mother, that's where she was. And after the first week or two that my mother went to meetings, my Uncle Tex, they had a little one-page pamphlet. I think I have a copy of it, as a matter of fact. But you just opened it up, and that was it. It was just like, you know, a folded piece of paper that was talking. It was the only pamphlet they had in Los Angeles. And my uncle looked it over, and he said, "This looks like a good deal to me, Sib. I think I can make a little money here." Yeah. Well, Uncle Tex at that time, I'll back up a little bit about him, he was a bad drunk. I mean, he was, from the get-go, from the time he was a young man, he raised hell. Great big guy, 6'2" or 6'3", 280 pounds. They didn't call him Big Tex for nothing, I'll tell you. His real name was Herman Aloysius. Nobody ever called him Herman. No one. Nope. Not my Uncle Tex. But he ran away from home very young because Papa was, they were raised in Texas, and my grandpa only knew one way of discipline, and that was, you know, spare the rod and spoil the child. And Tex got big enough that he wasn't going to have himself whipped anymore, so he left, and he threatened my grandpa, if he ever touched that baby, that was my mother, that he'd come back and beat him up. Well, Mama never got beaten again either. But it put a bond between the two of them that kept them as close as they could be, clear through the time until Tex died. But Mama started going to AA. Tex lost his drinking buddy, you know. He looked at it, and he said, maybe we can do something with this. At the time, he had a produce house on 5th and Main in Skid Row. And my Uncle Tex literally was known as King of Skid Row. My stepdad, who was stepdad number one, will not get confused here. I'll keep him identified for you. He was just the original Patsy, you know. And Tex was a con artist, and he parted my stepdad with money for every venture he ever had. It went from the produce warehouse to a boxing and wrestling arena. I guarantee you this man knew nothing about the boxing and wrestling, but Tex had a string of fighters down at the Main Street gym. At any rate, this was the environment in which I grew up. My stepdad would take me with him down to the produce house with all the winos there to pack fruit. He got a big old 10-ton truck, and we'd go out to Brawley and pick up a load of fruit. And I didn't know this was different than other kids. The reason I was with him is my mom was out drunk somewhere. I just didn't know it was different. I knew there were ground rules. You never woke her up before noon, and you never talked to her in a loud voice early in the morning or when she did get up, and you kept real quiet till she started talking. She had the flu a lot. Anyway, so what Tex had in mind was if he could get those winos sobered up, he could make more money out of his produce business. So he decided to go to the meeting at the mother group with my mother, and he did. And that was fine, except the group that was there at the time, you know, you got to understand, there were no traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. They were learning. by their mistakes as time went on, what did not work for them. And they broke every rule that our traditions allude to today. They did everything naturally, not knowing any better, not recognizing that the whole foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous could crumble unless they could have certain steps or rules or principles to follow. And so with Tex, he'd make a little money off of it. He showed up with his 12 winos in the back of a flatbed truck. The men at the mother group were mostly from the movie studios, and they just thought that was real tacky, and they weren't too appreciative of those winos. So I'm still drunk showing up in their meeting. And, well, my uncle was a very strong personality, and so were the leaders, Frank and Mort. Mama used to say she only heard Frank and Mort for the first 2 years because they were the leaders. And in those days, if a person had a meeting, they owned it. You know, it was like, that was their meeting. My uncle owned the hole in the ground until he died. And then he turned it over to an old boy named Duke Carson. And he was there till he died. And he gave it to Bud McDonald, who still got it. And that's it, right, isn't it? Yeah. So anyway, Tex shows up at the meeting. And here he is, this big, strong. People loved him or hated him. The strong personality. And he's confronted with these Frank and Mort, who, in their own right, that was their meeting. You know, he wasn't about to give any ground to Tex Adams, and who was he coming up from Skid Row with those winos, besides they smelled bad. So Tex went out, and he found a clubhouse in Huntington Park called the Hole in the Ground, the E-Bell Club. Nicknamed it the Hole in the Ground because it was downstairs in a basement. And he started the meeting. And he started that meeting for the guys on Skid Row and the fellows that had no other place to go because in those days there were no recovery houses. The general hospital did not accept drunks. People sometimes would take and shove them out the door of a car and drop them and run. But you certainly, if you took them in the door, they wouldn't accept them. And the only treatment they had that I'm aware of, and I know that because of my sponsor, Vivian, was sometimes they'd send him out to Camarillo, a state institution where they do shock therapy on them and shock everything out of their brains. Some of them came back and some did not. Vivian came back, thank God, because as time goes on in my story, she brought back to me what my uncle had given her. But at any rate, the Hole in the Ground was a place where my uncle always had a bag of Bull Durham. He always had 50 cents to send him to a flop house. He always had something on the back on a stove called Mulligan Stew, and that's whatever they put in it, because most of them came in hungry. And the Hole in the Ground flourished, but the mother group, they couldn't accept that way. How can this guy go out there and start a meeting? I mean, this is against our rules. We're going to excommunicate him. And they sent him a formal letter saying they were going to excommunicate him. Well, my uncle just stood up and he laughed. He said, you might as well try to control a sunset. He said, this thing is bigger than you are, fellas. Just sit back, because it's going to grow. This is more powerful than you are. And he was right. He was right. He came in to make a money-making proposition out of it, and he found God. He found a higher power. And he found a way to get back, give back. And he never understood how God could look down on him so kindly, a man who'd done the things he'd done. And he became a very deeply spiritual person, and I have no idea how many people's lives that my uncle's and my mother's affected down the years. But it was at the Hole in the Ground most of the time. That's where I went when I was a kid. Or they were at our house playing poker. Tex was quite a poker player. They don't do that a lot anymore. That caused a lot of dissension. The wives would get furious. There was no Al-Anon, you know. And then they'd come in. I've seen them come in, take the card table and tip it over and spread the cards under and grab their husbands by the ear and pull them out. When Mama first went into her first meeting, the article in the Saturday Evening Post had come out, and there were a lot of letters that went back east to Ruth Hawk. And Ruth had written my mother, and that's how she found the mother group. But shortly after that, they got stacks and stacks of letters and from women. See, there weren't any women. Women, they didn't have alcoholics. You were lushes, you were drunks, you were bums. It was not a disease. They didn't have a connection, not a clue. People had been trying to reform drunks for centuries, and nothing had worked until Bill and Bob found this solution. of one drunk talking to another. And that's why we're all sitting here today. I mean, my God, without that, where would we be? I know where I'd be. I think you'd be in the same place. Because we're not here because we had alternatives. We didn't stick around because we had alternatives. And if you're an alcoholic, like I was an alcoholic, you'll stick around one more day. And then another day after that until it all starts getting better. But in those days, without traditions and all of that, they gave Mama these letters. And by then, she's not drinking, so she realized she's got a kid. I'm in the back seat of the car with a coloring book while she's going out making 12-step calls. And we made 12-step call on this woman named Irma Levine. You all have heard this before, Carol. I'm going to tell it again anyway. So Irma Levine is a great big gal, and I remember seeing her. She evidently, she was in a little apartment or something, and I went in. Mama didn't keep me in the car. And I remember seeing this woman with her face all swelled up and bloated, and she's sick, and she doesn't feel good. And the next thing I know, she's living at our house. Mama moved them in. Because they didn't, again, they did not have recovery homes. They came, lived with us. So any, we had a big old 10-room house. My stepdad was comfortably fixed. And so we'd have them all over the place. In the bathtub on the floor, in the spare bedrooms, just everywhere. And a kitchen full of them playing poker and cigarette smoke so thick you couldn't see when you walked in. I never brought the kids home with me from school, I'll tell you that. They didn't. Well, Irma cleaned up really good. Big, long-legged woman. Looking good. Redhead, as I recall. And she was going to mother group with my mother. And Irma enjoyed the social aspects of the program, especially the socializing with the men. And as a result, the mother group decided that her behavior was inappropriate. And I have here a letter, a copy of a letter that they wrote to Irma Levine. And I just, it's absolutely priceless. I've got to read it because I'll tell you, if you don't appreciate the traditions, you certainly should after I read this. This is dated September 6th, 1941. Irma Levine, 939 South Gramercy Place, Los Angeles, California. Dear Mrs. Levine, at a meeting of the Executive Committee of the Los Angeles Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, held December 4th, 1941, it was decided that your attendance at group meetings was no longer desired. Until certain explanations and plans for the future were made to the satisfaction of this committee. This action has been taken for reasons which should be most apparent to yourself. It was decided that should you so desire, you may appear before members of this committee and state your attitude. This opportunity will be afforded you between now and December 15th, 1941, and you may communicate with us at the above address by that date. In case you do not wish to appear, we shall consider the matter closed and that your membership is terminated. And it's signed, Alcoholics Anonymous, Los Angeles Group. My God. Would that be a disaster if I got a letter? I'm being terminated? And so it goes, without traditions. No traditions when the power lies with the person rather than with the group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Oh, man. It's so much more serious than we can even possibly begin to understand. I know I was told by a sponsor, Vivian Hinton, the sponsor I had later on, that if I did anything, I did need to carry on and talk about the traditions and the importance of them. And I can't even begin to express what my feelings are, that if we, when we see the traditions being broken, that we need to speak up. We need to see that they're adhered to rigorously at all groups, at all groups. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Because without it, we won't be here. And it won't be here for our kids. And if you're like me and you have kids, probably some of them are. You know, I mean, five kids. My oldest daughter, April, is 45. She has needle tracks up and down both arms. She has warrants out for her arrest. She moves from county to county. And she hasn't had a pleasant life. She's had a very narrowed life from the day she was 16 years old. And it's been like this ever since, with brief periods of recovery, brief periods in and out of jail, long periods in and out of jail, long periods in recovery houses, and then back out in the streets where she's comfortable. And it breaks my heart. And I'm so glad to know today that I'm not in charge and that she's one of God's kids just like I am. And there's absolutely nothing I can do but love her, release her with love. It's very hard. It was particularly hard because April had a little girl that she drug around with her through all of this. And when my granddaughter Allison was five years old, April was put in jail and Allison came to live with me and I had her for about a year and a half. My daughters and I had a condo in Citrus Heights. By then I'd moved there. And we had some granddaughters with us and I had a couple of daughters with me and it was a wonderful time. And then the court came and took her away from me and gave her back to her mom when her mom was out of jail. And it broke my heart. And the lady from CPS sat in my living room and cried. She cried and I cried. Because what came into our life when Allison came to live with us, she was a catatonic. She wouldn't talk. She just sat and rocked herself and stared at the television. And I thought something terrible was the matter that would never get well. And by the time she left, she was a happy little girl chirping and pointing at stuff and saying, Grandma, buy me that. Grandma, I want that. And she had good taste. Allison is 13 now. And 6 months ago, she started calling me on the phone, and I'd had no contact with her for a long, long, long time. And she called me one day, and she said, Grandma, I want to go live with my dad. Can you help me? And my husband found an attorney and a friend and took her natural father, and they drove out and kind of rescued her in a situation that was not very pleasant. And she's now living with her dad in Gilroy, and she's a beautiful, beautiful girl. She's scrubbed all that makeup off her face and taken off the dangly earrings, and she's dressing like the other kids at school do now instead of the way she was. And there's hope. There's hope. You know, my mom always said, don't ever count anybody out. There's always hope. And I try to hold that in my heart when I think about April. And I know for Allison, there's a lot of hope because she's got a lot going for her now. But back to my own story. I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I knew so much about alcoholism, I could diagnose my friends. I mean, I knew instantly when they slipped into their alcoholism. No, I certainly didn't socialize or drink with those people that didn't drink the way I did. Oh, God. I mean, dull. You know, this stuff of one little glass of wine and you look at it all night. I didn't know anybody ever did that. I never did. It never occurred to me. And once I started drinking, I certainly didn't notice what they were doing. So I drank with the guys because the guys mostly drank like I did. And when we were at a party, we usually stayed in the kitchen, you know, where the booze was. So you're pouring it and drinking it and talking as people come and go. And that was where most of my time was. And I did real good. I developed a capacity for alcohol that, for my size and weight, was remarkable. Really was. I could put them to bed, clean the house, clear up the litter from the party, get up the next day, get those kids off to school, and I did that for a lot of years. I had met him, as I said earlier, out here at Aerojet. And on top of that, not only looking good, he drove a brand new Corvette. Oh, my God, I had died and gone to heaven. I mean, this was God's will for me, and I didn't even know about God's will then. But here is, finally, I have found a normie, you know? I have found a normie. Look at that. He's working. He looks good. He has a big family. Man, they're church people, really. His grandfather was a preacher in the Nazarene church. They were all very religious, you know, go to church on Sunday and Wednesday and things like that. Nobody seemed to smoke. We never talked about my past because that would probably have been only a little embarrassing. By then, I had got an early start at getting married and kind of popped. I had like a 2-year average is about what it amounted to. I kept looking for, there was this song in the olden days, someone to watch over me, you know, and so I kept finding him. And you don't do well when you meet him at Pat Wicker's 12-step house and they've got 30 days sober and he's a good dancer. But, you know, I'll get a draw next Tuesday. Go ahead and write a check because I'll give it to you. Now, I believed that. For 10 years, I was writing bad checks, and over and over and over and over again, I would believe it when he'd say, "Don't sweat it. I'll have the money in the bank for you by Monday." And it never happened, and I'd get charges. I felt like the bank owed me money. I mean, they should treat me special. Look what a good customer I was. Strangely enough, I've always felt like that. I have always felt like, for instance, Mama's sick. My mama's been sober 56 years. She's in Los Angeles. She's in a convalescent hospital. And I got a phone call last week that she was failing very rapidly, and I jumped in the car and drove down. And my husband said, "They've got radar on I-5 now. Use the speed control thing, you know." I hate that thing. It takes all the fun out of it. But I promised him that I would go the speed limit, no matter what. And you know, by the time I got to L.A., I was looking up, trying to find highway patrolmen because they should compliment me. You know? They should give me an award for being good. I have always felt that way. If I do something by the rules, I should be treated special. Compliment me. That was wonderful. I never broke the speed limit. Now, the other reason I didn't is I can't go back to traffic school for another year. There's a little motivation there. Selfish, self-centered motivation. I do have a tendency to have a heavy foot. But at any rate, we raised those kids and life was not bad, and pretty soon the parties became more and more and our communication became less and less, and things started getting pretty grim around the household. And we finally had one of those arrangements where I raised the kids and did what took care of that end of it, and he took care of his business. And sometimes we spoke, sometimes we didn't. One, I was a redhead most of the time in those days, and over a period of time, I went from red hair to blonde hair, and he didn't notice. And I kind of hurt my feelings. Towards the end of our marriage altogether, I quit talking to him for one solid year, and he did not notice. Now, that's honest to God truth. All I did was nod. I would nod because he lectured me all the time. He was very bright, funny guy, brilliant. You know, and he'd talk about neutrinos and black holes and, esoteric stuff. And I just sit there and nod and smile and think about other things and think, oh, God, you know. Sometimes I worked and I'd be sitting in front of the computer and I'd think if I could put a little cyanide in his coffee, nobody'd know. So we did not have what you'd call a close personal relationship when finally our drinking had come to that point. And I think most of us get there. Again, that's why we're here. The drinking had reached that point that I couldn't drink enough to get drunk. I couldn't stop my brain from going around and around and around and around on the hopelessness of the situation. The house is in foreclosure. We have a wrecked car in the garage, wrecked with no insurance. Hadn't made a payment on that car for a year. Hadn't made a payment on the second trust deed for a year. I didn't know it at the time, however. He was beginning to sit in a catatonic state and became unemployed and unemployable. I quit my last job at that point in time because I became so paranoid. I was absolutely convinced they were taping my personal phone conversations. Interestingly enough, I found out later on they were. Yeah, the FBI came to my house one time and so did the CIA. It was quite an interesting company, actually. They built explosive devices and had some real acts of violence. So they did tape all conversations that were outside or inside. But the time finally came, I ran away from home. Now, when I ran away from home in Hollister, my kids were raised. My youngest was 17. I was 50 years old. I thought I was 18 in my head. I had not a grasp of years had gone by. And you know when you're drinking, how they just kind of zip by. It's slow going, but I had no great recollection of time. Now, I still wanted to dress like my kids. We traded clothes. Kids said I had good taste. Well, I mean, from a 15-year-old's perspective or a 17-year-old, perhaps so. I had not a clue where I should be in terms of maturity. And that's when I ran away, and I reached that point that so many of us, and I've heard this story over and over and over again, so many of us reach a point whenever that last drunk is, you know? And we don't know when it's going to be. That's the beautiful part. No one ever says, hey, this is going to be your last drunk. Get some really good stuff. No. I'd run away from home because I knew I was drinking because of him. And our friends all drank too heavy. And if I got away from them, I wouldn't have to do that anymore. And when I woke up one morning so hungover, I couldn't stop throwing up. And I was absolutely in a state of pitiful and incomprehensible desperation. I heard myself saying, God, help me. I didn't even believe in God. A long time ago, I trashed that one. But I heard myself saying it out loud. And when I said it out loud, I heard in my mind's ear, I heard myself saying, my life is unmanageable. And I knew there was a first part of it. That if my life is unmanageable, the first part was I was an alcoholic, and the thought occurred to me, if I am an alcoholic, there's help. You see, I had tried psychiatrists. I'd been to one just shortly before I left home. When I went to see him, I was full of pills and I was full of booze, and not once did he say, do you have a drinking problem? How much do you drink? He told me to get a hobby and charge me $200. I told him I was thinking about suicide. Truly, truly. I said, I went to him because I knew that when you start planning your suicide, this is not normal. Normal people do not do this. I had a bag full of pills I'd been snatching from my kids and saving of enough. Because you don't want too much. If you take too much, you throw up. I know that because I had tried it. I tried the backseat of a car with the motor going, and nobody ever tells you in the movies that you can't breathe those fumes. They hurt. You just end up coughing a lot. So I gave that one up. But I had my baggie, and I knew what to take. And I knew that was crazy. And I saw this man of great learning and experience. Isn't it interesting that only one alcoholic can truly, truly know that state of mind that we get to when we're there? And thank God I was there. I'd had enough. Because that moment of clarity got me to my first AA meeting in Campbell, California. And I had a lady that told me to write a gratitude list, that I didn't have to wallow in all that self-pity. That was very offensive to me. But I did know. I knew in my heart and without a doubt that if I was an alcoholic, Alcoholics Anonymous was the solution. It never fails us. Never fails us. We may get off the track, but the program is always here, and it always works. It always works no matter what. And I went back briefly several times to that husband, and then eventually we parted, which was best for both of us. And in sobriety, I found a job again, went back to Aerojet after all those years. They rehired me by them, a senior citizen, and they're giving me a job. I couldn't believe it. I had been homeless in sobriety after we lost the house. I had my daughter Holly had a little girl who was 3, and then Holly had a baby, and we took Callum to the hospital because she wasn't right, and they told us this baby was not going to live, and they couldn't tell us if she was going to live 2 years or if she would go that night, and it made my daughter just went crazy, and she had a little business in San Juan Bautista, so I moved in with her. And we nursed the baby, and I got to take care of Callan at night because she had a progressive muscular spinal atrophy, and that meant when you're feeding her the formula that she could choke. And my daughter trusted me in sobriety because I was a sober woman to care for Callan, and I was the only other person that could feed that baby. And it was very precious time to me that I was trusted, literally, with this child's life. And I took her at night because she'd quit breathing. And when she quit breathing, the apnea monitor would go off and my daughter'd go nuts again. Well, Callum passed away, which was inevitable. And Ruth remembers she was there at that time for me. She was there. At any rate, my daughter Holly just went absolutely nuts. And so often this happens with when you lose a child. And her marriage ended, and her husband had gone into head over heels into cocaine. And she decided that she was going to give her little girl back to, after they she divorced her husband, and she was going to take Erin and give her to her dad. And Holly was going to go off to Los Angeles and be a dancer. And oh my God, you know, this is not going to work. I was working at Aerojet, and I said, Holly, Erin has lost enough. This child has lost. Both sets of grandparents were divorced. She lost her baby sister. Her mom and dad are divorced, and her dog ran away. I said, let's find a place for just 1 year and move in together and make a home for Erin. I said, just try it for a year. If it doesn't work, do what you want to do, but let's give her that much of a chance. And so Holly did, and it was incredibly good because Holly finally decided what she wanted to do, and she registered at Sac State in the RN program and was accepted and loved it. I mean, she loved stuff. I couldn't look at the pictures. Good God, you know. She just had a natural bent. She was a person who loved to care for people. And Erin started blooming in school, and at the same time, we got Allison in our lives. Remember me telling you about my little granddaughter earlier? So the girls were like sisters, and they shared a bed. And shortly after that, my youngest daughter, Kimmy, had married a cowboy in Hollister, and she got tired of rodeos, and she moved in with us. And so we were the girls at Frank's place, and by then there were five of us. And at the end of the first year, it was working out so well, we decided to try it for one more year. And at the end of that year, Holly was getting closer and closer to graduating. We decided to try it for one more year, and we did. And so for 3 years, my daughters and I, as adults, adult females, shared a condo in Citrus Heights. And it was like God's gift to me as a sober woman that my children got to know me in sobriety. Because the mother they had known before was one that was there and one that wasn't there. Because the minute I put a drink in my body, I separated and isolated myself emotionally from those kids. And I went into my own world, and I wasn't there for them in that respect. My body could be sitting there, but I wasn't there. What a gift. What a gift. We did. We had a good time. We played together, and they took care of me because I was single. And I'd promised myself I was never going to get married again until I met the right one. And I didn't care what. And you know, 14 years, man, that was a record for me, I'll tell you. I got married the first time when I was 16. So to stay single for 14 was like in sobriety, too. Yeah, that what a record. And I wanted to be well enough to have something to give this time. And at the end of 3 years, Holly finally got a place of her own. She was a year away from graduating and getting her RN BSN. And she had the opportunity to go on a flight to Cabo San Lucas with some friends. And somebody backed out of it. It was a flight club out of Morgan Hill. And she called me at work and said, guess what, Mom? I can't have dinner with you. I'm going to Cabo San Lucas. So she left, and the airplane crashed into the side of the mountain there. And I lost my daughter. Now, these things happen in sobriety. Life is not always just what we want it to be, and we don't get to write the script. What we get to do is to live it one day at a time, sober. And I had the opportunity to be so grateful for what God had given me, to have my daughter get to know me sober and to be able to participate in her life. And because I was single, my daughters were always trying to fix me up with some guy, you know. So my son had a boat. We water skied together. We snow skied together. We lived a lifetime in 3 years, and for that I'll be always grateful. Grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous and grateful to my God. He gave me a gift more priceless than pearls. Before this had occurred, I met a lady named Vivian Hinton. My Uncle Tex was Vivian's sponsor. He'd sent her to Camarillo for those treatments, you know, but 42 years had gone by, and it was after that baby died, and I went into this. I woke up one morning, I'd lived at Holly's place there for a year, and couldn't go to meetings and couldn't participate in meetings and knew I'd get drunk if I didn't find a sponsor. And I found Vivian and moved in with her and did an intensive fourth and fifth step And she gave back to me what my Uncle Tex had given her in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, it's like bread cast in the waters. And she said, Addie, we don't know what God's will is for you. You may never find someone and remarry. You might as well adjust to it. We don't know what God's will is. But in the meantime, if you just keep moving forward, putting one foot in front of the other, it's going to get better. And it did. And I got the job at Aerojet and got to live with my daughters and got to share with them. I have to tell you that today, if I had written a script for my life, I couldn't have written it as well. Things don't get any better than I have it today. And it has nothing to do with Corvettes, and it's got nothing to do with big fancy homes. But when I moved to Sacramento, I started going to the McClellan group out there near, they said start at the air base, and they had one on Thursday night. And this great big tall handsome man walked in the door with snow white hair and 6'2" or 6'3", cowboy boots. God, you know, fellow wore cowboy boots and called me baby. I was in love, you know. But I gotta tell you, I went home and I told the girls about him. I said, oh my God, I have seen this man and he is so beautiful. And they said, well, Mom, go for it, go for it. Well, okay. So I started in 12, you know, I mean, you gotta take care of these newcomers. I wanted to be sure he's on the right path. And he came in awful angry, and I sure did want to pass on some good information to him. You know, it was like, I told him, yeah, I got him a copy of Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox and said, now this will absolutely help you with your anger. And so after the meetings, I'd talk to him a little bit. Finally got around to asking, you know, kind of trying to find out if he was involved, and oh God, he was. He was with a lady and had been for 7 or 8 years, and said, oh, that's that. My daughter still encouraged me to, you know. I said, no, you know, if he'd cheat on Mary, he'd cheat on me. I'm not going to do it. He's too much of a newcomer, blah, blah, blah. God, I was being so pious. I had a little halo around here. Well, we did meet kind of like with nobody knew about it, but we met occasionally for lunches, and that was all. About every 3 to 6 months, he'd give me a call at work, and we'd go have lunch. Today, we're married. Yeah. Been married a little over 2 years. Went together for a year before that. It really took a lot for both of us to get uninvolved. Unfortunately, when Holly died, my friend, I had a buddy in AA, and he was with me through the funeral. He was there to hold me. And God love him. He asked me to marry him, and I'm brain dead with pain and grief, and I married him, and it was a mistake for him, and it was a mistake for me. He's my buddy today. He's a good man. It did not last very long. But I shattered my record, you know, unfortunately. But my dear husband, Bill, he knows all about me. He's heard all of the stories of my war stories from the past because we went to the same meeting. We talked at that meeting and shared for 6 years. And one day, the day came when he was uninvolved, and he'd called me and said, if you ever find yourself uninvolved, I'd like to take you to dinner. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I am. And he said, well, very good. I said, when? He said, what time shall I pick you up? I said, when do you mean? He says, tonight. And that's the way it was. He said, you got away from me once. You're not getting away from me again. And so we share the program today. And I heard Kathy earlier talking about loving Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard my stepdad say one time that he has a love affair with Alcoholics Anonymous that gets better and better all the time, like any love affair. If you have a love affair with your wife, your relationship, it gets better over any period of time. And I didn't understand what he meant, because I'd never had one that got better. And today I know exactly what he meant. My love affair with my husband has grown and grown and grown, and we share a deep spiritual experience and the love of the program and faith in our God. And my love affair with Alcoholics Anonymous grows and doubles all the time because it has given me more and more. It's given me the ability to deal with life as it is and to participate in my own life. You know, I always had a way of numbing out and not being there. I didn't want the pain. I didn't want the hurt. And I always had something to fix it so it would make it numb and I wouldn't have to feel it. My whole life was not feeling, man, that's being dead. You know, that's being dead. And today I feel every single thing. I feel joy. I feel anger. I have pain. I'm human. I participate in my own journey, and life is a journey, and it just doesn't get any better than this. I have a letter here. My mom and Uncle Tex were awful close, and the hole in the ground grew by leaps and bounds, and they were sponsored everybody in the whole world there, and many of his sponsees are still alive. But when Uncle Tex died, my mom was devastated. That had been her big brother that had taken care of her, and they drank together, they played together, they bootlegged together, done everything, and they got sober together, and they went in AA 12-step calls together, and by God, Tex was, I tell you, he was quite a sponsor. He'd keep his sponsees busy. He'd make up addresses, you know, when people's foot, yeah, when the 12-step houses started coming around, or recovery houses, he'd make up addresses if he didn't have any calls and send them out looking for them, you know. Kept him sober till the meeting started, yeah. He wasn't above that. They'd stop at a phone booth and call back and say, hey, Tex, we're at the corner of Vermont and Figueroa, but there's no house here by that address. He'd say, oh, my God, is that what I said? I meant. And then he'd send him off somewhere else. Because, as the other lady said, work with an alcoholic will always save the day. When I don't have to be poor little anymore. You know, I don't have to be, because I know I have a telephone and I can call and I can talk to a newcomer. And when things and life comes in and it's not always the way I wanted the script, it's not what I wanted to deal with, I know what I can do. I can talk to a newcomer and I can start writing down those things for which I'm grateful. I am so grateful today to the heritage that I inherited from my mother and my stepdads of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because not only did it include the old days, the foundations of Alcoholics Anonymous, but the way that they had to do it. And it could not have been easy to be the only woman at a meeting. In those days, women didn't share on a personal level. They'd say things like, I drank too much too long. And they didn't talk about the things they did. I remember when at one point my mother would stand up in front of the podium and she'd say, I'm Sybil Doris Adams Stratton Hart Maxwell Willis Corwin, and I'm an alcoholic. And if I was at the meeting, I would die. I would slither down in my seat and I'd think, how could she do that? How could she do that? That is so embarrassing. And today I can stand up here and say, hey, I'm a multi-marrier. Guess what, guys? You know, that's the way it was. But I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to blame them. I don't have to have someone outside of me fixing me. I know it comes from me, that it is an inside job. And when my Uncle Tex died, my mom went into a depression, and she wrote Bill Wilson. She said, Bill, I don't know what I'm going to do. She picked up the hole in the ground, took it over, and started in leading the meetings and never missed a beat. But she got numb and didn't feel anything, and pretty soon Bill wrote her back a letter, and I'll read it to you. It's November 6, 1952. It's my dear Sybil. Thanks for your letter of October 21st. It was just about the most stirring thing I have read in many a day. The real test of our way of life is how it works when the chips are down. Though I've sometimes seen AAs make rather a mess of living, I've never seen a sober one make a bad job of dying. But the account you gave me of Texas' last days is something I shall treasure always. I hope I can do half as well when my own time comes. I am one who believes that in my Father's house there are many mansions. If that were not so, there couldn't be any justice. I can almost see Tex sitting on the front porch of one, right now, talking in the sunlight with others of God's ladies and gentlemen who've gone on before. I certainly agree with you that little was left in Tex's grave. All he had was left behind in the hearts of the rest of us. And he carried just that same amount forward to where he is now. If you like what I've said, please read it to the Huntington Park group. In any case, congratulate them for me that they had the privilege of knowing a guy like Tex. And as for you, my dear, there's no need to give you advice. How well you understand that the demonstration is the thing after all. It isn't so much a question of whether we have a good time or a bad time. The only thing that will be asked is what we do with the experience we have. That you are doing well with your tough lot is something for which I and many others are bound to be grateful. Life is but a long day in school. Some of the lessons are hard and others are easy. I know you will keep on learning and passing on to others what you learn. What more does one person need to know about another? Affectionately yours, Bill. And I thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.